A Triple Decker Story. Part 1. Ladies First. Those five men at lunch in the restaurant are talking about women. Three are wearing starched collars, suits with vests, and have watch chains across their middles. One of them recently put in his first telephone, warning his family not to make a call unless it was an emergency. That guy, Emil Decker, felt satisfied with the way he handled his three daughters and his wife. He contributed little to the conversation, except for an occasional grunt of interest. They fell silent as the cheeky young waitress poured a second round of coffee, cleaned off the table, and left their checks. "Women," laughed George, a shoe salesman whose wife had failed to become pregnant. "They have it made. While the men sweat out a living, they lounge around at home in bedroom slippers or go to the beauty parlor for expensive permanents. Or take the kids to the park," Willie Hahn said, "spreading out a blanket on the grass, relaxing and listening to the birds. You come home a wreck, and half the time to a warmed-over dinner. It's like a lifetime vacation for them."
"That's what it comes down to in the end," Sid, known as the Cigar, said, lighting a Havana. He was into his second divorce. "The men break their backs hauling in the money so the women can spend it on clothes, on strawberry shortcake in Schrafts, meeting God knows who there. Once they start going to Schrafts, watch out. Then they get stiffed if you don't help them on with their coats, open the car door for them, take them to fancy restaurants, hold the umbrella up when it rains. On top of that, you better carry heavy insurance premiums in the event you die so they can wallow in a life of luxury. Women have 100 ways to make you do exactly what they want. They cry, they scream, they faint. They threaten you with divorce and alimony payments that trap you for the rest of your life. Right, Rizzo?" He turned to the fourth of the quintet.
"Yeah,"
Rizzo agreed. He was carrying a heavy second mortgage,
and most of the time you get something heated out of a can.
Broadening their conversation, they confidentially revealed to each other what sports they were, how gallantly they treated the women. The two words they agreed described it were "ladies first."
"Yeah, it's always ladies first," Willie Hahn agreed. "Ladies first. When you're trying to get on a crowded bus, when you're stepping into a shaky rowboat, or when you're running for your life out of a burning building, ladies first, ladies first. They get the priorities."
He looked at Decker, who remained silent.
"Don't they?"
"I see it around me all the time. But thank God, not me. Knock wood." And Decker rapped on the table. "I'm in control.
Give that gentleman a great big cigar," said Sid.
Decker was a no-nonsense customer, a 10-hour-a-day, hard-working businessman, his life devoted to his small factory, from which he made a good living until recently. He was a proud man, a clean man, well-built, but becoming alarmed at his developing belly. He wore pince-nez glasses. To save time in the morning, he shined one shoe a day. A planner. He was uncertain as to how many children he wanted. But when the first was a daughter, and the second was a daughter, and the third was a daughter, his soul began to evaporate. Who would inherit the factory? Swallowing his angst at his wife's ridiculous one-note productions, he found himself of an afternoon at his doctor's office for a high colonic, where he received shocking information while casually discussing his family.
You do know that it is the male sperm that decides the sex of the child, the doctor informed him.
This unexpected blow struck hard, for he had given his wife another chance to make good, having impregnated her for the fourth time. Decker now realized he had only himself to blame when the next child would arrive a screaming female. His delirious capers, when told it was a boy, came to a sudden end upon learning the infant had to be placed in an incubator. It was his understanding that incubator babies shrank and that his son would turn into a midget. Whereupon he fainted. His wife, Hedda, a small, quiet woman of sweet disposition, a natural talent as a housekeeper, cook, and sock donner, kept things running on a minimal budget, content with her nest and her flock. Their eldest daughter, Edith, a sharp, competent, shorthand secretary at 21, held a position in a legal firm. She had little patience with her 18-year-old sibling, Marion, a more easygoing, sensuous girl who was inclined to leave her bed unmade and her stockings draped over the chair. Their snub-nosed sister, Judith, a 15-year-old flirt, was her father's favorite. He chuckled at her childish fantasy of becoming an actress, a profession he regarded as the road to prostitution. Decker's hopes for his daughters were that they would marry men like himself, settle down to producing a family and provide comfort in his old age. Edith had considered college, perhaps law, but Decker held it would only be thrown away time and money, since marriage would prevent her from pursuing a career not suitable for women in any case. Little did he know, she hated men and would have to be dragged to the altar. The girls, and Marion in particular, sensed that their brother Joshua, who had not turned out to be a midget after all, had become the object of his father's visions. Decker had not participated in the talk at lunch, his mind preoccupied with other matters. Business had been deteriorating. In his last conversation with him, their accountant had intoned the grim facts. He passed these on to his partner, Osterman, a chubby, excitable man in charge of the clattering machine shop. They manufactured cardboard boxes. Osterman, heavily in debt, hinted that business had fallen off because Decker failed to bring in enough orders. They had words over that. "You have more men than you need in the factory," Decker countered. He had watched Osterman with his feet up in his tiny office while a machine in need of repair lay idle for days. After a bitter argument, they agreed to let two men go, but not Osterman's incompetent nephew, the last hired. "We have to start cutting our take in half for a couple of months," Decker said.
"I can't live on half," Osterman cried.
If you stopped playing cards every night, you could. Osterman jumped up.
That's none of your business.
Well, it is now, because if we don't draw less, the business could fail.
And where did you get that?
Hamilton. I spoke to him this morning.
I never wanted him for an accountant. He's a penny pincher. What did he say?
3 months. We gotta turn it around in 3 months. That wrangle had taken place a couple of weeks ago. Things were still teetering. Decker, having invested in stocks, had a substantial cushion, but he knew Osterman remained in trouble. On the subway ride home, Decker began to recall the lunch exchanges. It was true that men were always sweating it out and having to carry huge insurance policies and all that. And it was true that Hedda had taken the children to the park and sat on the benches in the sunshine while he was running his ass off to beat the competition. Now the home telephone bills were creeping up. It was all petty, he realized, but somehow it gnawed at him. His lunch began coming up on him. He was tired and gassy as he approached his white clapboard house, standing in a row of exactly similar white clapboard houses. As he opened the front door, he heard Marion, his middle daughter, talking animatedly on the telephone. She had apparently been babbling for some time.
"Oh, yes, Miss Riley," she was saying. "That's exactly what I'm going to do."
She saw him coming toward her and froze.
"I have to go now, Miss Riley. Bye."
She hung up.
"Hello, Papa," she said,
pushing her hands nervously through her long bob. "Who was that?" Decker asked, removing his coat.
"Miss Riley, from school. The school nurse."
She took his coat and hung it in the closet. "Didn't you go to school today?"
"Of course I did."
"So why did she call you?"
"I called her."
"Couldn't wait until tomorrow? You had to call her immediately?"
"It was something personal, important," Marion mumbled.
"Where's your mother?"
"She got stuck on the subway. There was some kind of tie-up in Manhattan. She called a few minutes ago."
"What's she doing in Manhattan? Isn't dinner ready?"
"She prepared it before she left. She's going to heat it up. She had an appointment with a friend for lunch in Shrafts."
Part 2. Ladies Last. Miss Riley, the school nurse, a tall, slim woman with a jaundiced view of the world, ran her small clinic like an operating theater. A kid with a cut finger had to lie down on the surgical bed Miss Riley had gotten donated to the school, and departed with a bandage that could have been suitable for an amputation. Marion, her volunteer assistant for 3 years, became her devotee, visiting Miss Riley's small apartment, which featured a stand-up skeleton, charts of the human body, and a large framed photo of Florence Nightingale. When Miss Riley took part-time afternoon jobs at the local hospital on weekends, Marion volunteered there as well. She swiped a hospital smock and slept in it. Turkish coffee was one of Miss Riley's favorites, and while she and Marion sipped, Miss Riley shared her views.
"It took us over 100 years to get the vote," Miss Riley said through clamped teeth, her bitterness concealed by her hospital-whispering Irish voice. "There are no women scientists. Wipe the kids, wash the dishes, cook the meals, clean the house, and kiss the boys goodnight. Not me. The guy I want hasn't been born yet."
This devastating revelation shook Marion, since both Douglas Fairbanks, her screen hero, and Richard Dix, another one, seemed like perfectly desirable men.
"Who's that?" Marion asked, nodding at a picture of a young soldier with an easy smile and lively eyes. "My brother. He was killed in the war, at the Marne. I begged him not to enlist." "But you were there yourself," Marion said. "You go where you're needed. I'm a nurse." "That's what I'm going to be. I've made up my mind."
"Don't say I didn't warn you."
"I'll never say that," Marion promised,
aware that the maneuvering necessary before she could announce her decision would be complicated. Having reached graduation, she could no longer delay. She brought it to her father's attention through her mother's intercession. She had never seen her mother defy him, but that was not what she expected her to do, only to arrange it.
"I don't think he'll like it," her mother said nervously. "He thinks you should be a kindergarten teacher. You remind him of his kindergarten teacher." "That's crazy, Mama." "Well, you know, in some ways he's a very strange man. He never forgets anything. He never forgot how you broke a test tube in your hand in school." "Miss Riley said she'd be glad to speak to him."
"Oh, I wouldn't mention Miss Riley to him. A woman her age and not married. He's convinced there must be something wrong with her." When she found the opportunity, Hedda Decker spoke to her husband.
"What I wanted to tell you," she said, after some introductory remarks, "was that Marion wants to become a nurse."
"Over my dead body," he said. That evening, Decker sat in the lamp-lit living room, rarely used except for guests on behalf of the new Oriental carpet, listening behind closed doors to the appeal of his daughter. "You know," he said, after she had spoken, "I have no favorite children. I want the best for everybody. You think you're a grown-up person because you're almost 18, but the fact is, you're such a youngster yet and have a lot to learn. You go to school. You see something or someone that makes you excited. Oh, you think, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that how they call it, the cat's meow? Oh, if only I could do that. Oh, how happy I would be. If I could only be an actress, or a bathing beauty, or a tightrope walker."
"But I don't want to be a tightrope walker, Papa. Nursing is a noble profession. Did you ever hear of Florence Nightingale?"
"Who? What is she, a bird?"
"No, she was the most famous nurse in the world."
"Yeah, well, she probably had a lot of money in back of her. And I'll bet no man ever married her. And do you realize the number of people who come to the hospital with different diseases? Do you remember when you had chicken pox? You had the worst case of chicken pox in the entire family. I felt so sorry for you, I went right out and bought you that expensive doll. Is that what you want? Another chicken pox? Listen to me, Marion. You're a beautiful girl. You'll find a husband. You'll get married. You'll have a home, children, a car. How many nurses can afford a car,
I don't want a car, Papa. I want my life, and I still have the doll.
You don't want a husband either.
I'm young. I want to try things. I love chemistry. It's like magic. I love nursing. I can earn a good living.
I never knew you were the type of girl who had crazy ideas in her head. I'm not going to let you run away with yourself. I will not let you go around carrying sick people's pots for the rest of your life. That's finished. Now, we'll talk about something else. Mama told me you needed a new coat. Is that right? What kind of coat did you have in mind?
If it's the money, Papa, take what you would spend on a coat and I'll add it to my savings. My babysitting money alone.
Decker sprang up angrily. It's a dirty job filled with diseases. I don't want to hear another word. We'll decide over the summer what you should do, and that's it. He left the room. Shaken, Marion spent the next few weeks, sometimes in tears, sometimes in bitter thoughts about her father, and sometimes in consultation with Miss Riley. Miss Riley listened sympathetically, if a bit uptight.
Your father's a man. All your life you're going to have to deal with men. You better get used to it. Of course, some men are better than others, but very few.
Miss Riley lit a cigarette. She is certainly a daring woman, Marion concluded, and determined to do whatever Miss Riley suggested.
You have to make up your mind whose career plans you're going to let control your life, yours or your father's.
She provided a list of nursing schools around the country.
Show it to him. Show him how many women are choosing it for a profession. It's an accredited college. He wants my brother to go to college, not me.
The evening Marion chose for her second talk with her father was the day he had had another confrontation with his partner. To Decker, the factory was the accumulation of everything he had put his heart into. His creation. His baby. He saw Osterman, his slovenly partner, as a come lately, with no pride in anything, even in the way he dressed. Decker never left the house with unshined shoes or a stained tie. Osterman, he noticed, didn't own a tie without a stain. After rehearsing once more the accountant's warning that they must pull in their horns and cut expenses to the bone, their salaries in particular, he had asked Osterman to come up with an idea. Osterman said,
"Hire an arsonist. They're all doing it. Burn part of the factory down. Collect the insurance and refinance. That's my suggestion."
Decker stared at him for a full minute, slowly rose and walked out, slamming the door behind him. On the subway ride home, the words in the evening paper eluded him, his anger grinding the image of Osterman to bits. When he entered the house, Hedda was relaxing on the front porch. From the parlor came the sound of someone practicing Flight of the Bumblebee on the piano, its agitated music accompanying him upstairs. As he removed his jacket and tie and changed into a pair of slippers, Hedda came into the bedroom. He appeared pale.
"Emil, what's the matter?"
He sat on the bed, his head in his hands, his lips tight into his mouth, repressing his emotion. "Your whole life can go down the drain," he said, because of one lousy bastard. She knew who he meant.
Emil, she said, you knew what he was all the time.
I'll borrow the money. I'll buy him out, that bastard, he cried. At dinner, three members of the family were absent. Only Judith, the youngest of the girls, was at the table with them. Edith, the eldest, was taking a business English course. Decca had mockingly asked her if business English was a different language. Marion was visiting a handicapped friend, and Joshua attended the Boy Scouts, where he was preparing for a merit badge in cooking.
That's exactly what I need now, a son with an apron, Decca commented on learning of this.
When Marion came home, Decca was finishing a telephone call to his lawyer about how to get rid of his partner. In the parlor, he sank into the club chair with a heavy sigh, yawned, and stared at her.
Papa, she said, did you think any more about the talk we had? There is nothing in the world I want to do more than work in the medical profession. I know what respect you have for Dr. Cutler.
Women don't become doctors.
Some do.
I don't know a man in this world who would go to see a woman doctor, he said, his arms folded across his chest.
Women would, and nurses are just as important. Sometimes more important. Without them, they couldn't run hospitals.
He stood up. I will not have a daughter of mine becoming a shitpot carrier, and that's the end of it.
Then he left the room, clenching his fists, and went upstairs to bed. Part 3. Ladies Always. On Sunday morning, as she stood watching in her nightgown from the window of the bedroom she shared with her younger sister Judith, Marion saw her father washing the car outside the garage in back of the house. Joshua held a powerfully spouting hose, directing it according